Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun. I say it's all right. It's all right.
So hey everybody, it's Tuesday at 4 on the West Coast. This is Eric Mann. You're listening to Voices from the Frontlines. Today's show is part of a series of shows we're having that I don't know how long they'll go, but certainly throughout, I think, all of June, which is to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Mississippi Summer in the broadest possible way, both to delve into its phenomenally rich history and the endless lessons for today, and also to try to grasp a period that many of you did not live through, and to try to take a lot of its lessons, its energy, its perspective, and bring it in to help inform today's movement. So today we have Charles Payne, movement historians, and Charles has written a lot of books. I'm going to read some of the text. Charles, are you on the phone already?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Charles. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
Okay, I'm just going to read a little bit of your bio, and then we'll start with some questions. So Charles is the Frank Hickson Professor in the School of Social Service Administration at the University of Chicago, and of course the most important book that he's written is I've Got the Light of Freedom, which is, or that's my perspective, is one of the just very, very finest books on organizing that takes you inside the organizing process in a way that those of us who are organizers do understand, but very few people understand. So I think the way you describe the texture of the building of the movement in Mississippi was phenomenal. And I saw you at the SNCC reunion 3 years ago, I believe, and it's great to have you on Voices today.
Oh, and thank you so much for having me, and thanks for the kind words about the book.
Let's talk about the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer, and I started with that we're going to be doing interviews. I'm going down to Mississippi on Monday. I'll be going with Julian Lamb from Voices from the Frontlines, which is our radio show. I want our listeners to know that we've been given a real gift by our own station, KPFK Pacifica, which is we'll be running the regular Voices show next Tuesday at 4, also about Mississippi Freedom Summer, and that'll be with Judy Richardson and Clay Carson, who we also just pre-taped this morning, so they will be, while I'm down in Mississippi, that'll be the 4 o'clock show. And then starting Wednesday, the station's been nice enough to give Voices half an hour every night on the evening news from 6 to 6:30, where we'll be doing interviews from Freedom Summer. And then there's also going to be a special, it looks like, on Sunday, also from Freedom Summer for an hour. And a lot of this, we think, is going to be able to go throughout the whole Pacifica network that Alan Minsky and others are trying to make happen. So we're also going down with a filmmaker, Catherine Murphy. She did a film called Maestra about the literacy program in Cuba in 1961. She's bringing a filmmaker and a cameraman. So we're going to try to record the history of the history. So very exciting. And in that context, Charles, very nice to have you on the show.
Well, thank you.
Well, let's start with a premise, and I'll start with something I sent you in an email. I don't know if you got it, but in your book, I've Got the Light of Freedom, I think one of the things that was great about it is you showed, in my interpretation, the explosive relationship between the longtime veterans of Mississippi, like Amzi Moore and many others, and also I'd say the critical role of the NAACP that I didn't fully understand because, frankly, its more conservative role in the North. I didn't understand its heroic role in the South. And yet the explosive combination of the students coming to the South, often college educated, but to make it even more complicated, many of those students had grown up in the South. Some had been in, like Sam Block, had been in the Army and came back. So this sort of explosive mix of different classes inside the Black community and different experiences bringing an explosive consciousness to the South at that poor history. Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah, I think the only correction I would make is that when you describe the students prior to 1964, they are not coming to the South. They are in the South. They are Southerners. I think my memory is right that in 1963, Howard Zinn's description of the Mississippi SNCC staff is that there was something like three-quarters Black college students, almost entirely first-generation college students. So even though they were in school, they were by and large coming from working class backgrounds, and they were rooted in Southern communities and Southern traditions. But beyond that, I think you're absolutely right that for whatever reasons, and I'm going to avoid language like romanticizing the 60s, I'm trying very hard to avoid that, we tend not to see that older generation of activists, a great many of them who became active either in World War II or the wake of World War II, the people that Bob Moses said taught him to read Mississippi when he got there, and that all the early SNCC workers would say made it possible for them to survive.
Well, first of all, thank you for the correction, because I think you're absolutely right that, as you said, that many of the students were already in the historically black colleges and universities, and that's an important correction. And building on your point is, let's talk about the role of the military and even the role of armed traditions inside the South. That is to say, I know that Amzie Moore carried a gun, that many, many people had shotguns in their homes. And what do you think was the role of the returning GI in terms of shaping the post-war civil rights movement and moving towards black liberation movement?
Let me do a plug for someone else's book. Charlie Cobb just published a book. It's This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed. And, of course, Charlie Cobb was a SNCC field secretary.
Right.
It is a wonderful treatment of these very questions and looking at them over a span of time, that's something like 150 years. It's a really great book. I hope people will take a look at it. In terms of the role of veterans, again, my memory is that Mississippi alone sent 88,000 people into the service. Amzie Moore is one. Medgar Evers is another. And it's really clear that a couple of things happen. One is people come back with a sense of having paid some dues and being entitled. Time and time again, you see in the record people saying that we fought for this democracy. We actually want some of it. John Dittmer's remarkable books has as its opening scene Medgar Evers in Decatur, Mississippi. I believe the year is 1946, but say the first election after the war. And he and some other veterans put on their uniforms and march to the courthouse intending to vote. And a kind of confrontation takes place. They don't get to vote that day. But the notion that they put on those uniforms to make a statement about what it was that gave them the right to citizenship, that they had earned them. And I think the other thing that happens, thinking about Amzie Moore, he has this wonderful story where I believe he's in India, maybe Burma. And he looks at the physical ruins of some civilization that had existed thousands of years ago. And he says to himself something like, damn, these things can fall too. That is, embedded social systems can die. And I think that's one of my favorite examples of something else that the experience of the war did. It demystified white people. Even though the armed forces were overwhelmingly segregated at that time, people had enough contact of a different kind with white people to stop thinking of them as some special people.
Well, I think one of the things that's always interesting is that wars have historically been tremendous opportunities for oppressed people to sort of play both sides. If you look at the Civil War, that without the South's desire to secede, throwing into motion large numbers of black people who had been trapped inside of a not just futile but suffocating experience of lack of experience, are thrown into a set of experiences including contact with the Northern troops. You look at, as you said, the war in Vietnam, the war in World War II, for the colonial people all over the world, it seems like every time the capitalists and the imperialists have a war, the contradictions of those wars have often turned out to be good for the oppressed participating in it, at least at the level of sort of expanding your consciousness, if only because the system had no choice but to give you that consciousness.
Exactly, but you probably know this better than I, but isn't it a pretty fundamental tenet of Marxism that one of the ways in which the working class is going to develop consciousness is through being used as tools in the wars of capitalists?
Well, absolutely, and I think that what Marxism, and I would say, just to say, I come out of the sort of third world Marxist, more of the Lenin, Mao, Kwame Nkrumah school of that terrific tradition, is the combination, of course, that capitalism does its thing, right? It has its internal contradictions. It doesn't try to raise the consciousness of anybody. But in the process of playing out its contradictions, it gives people a lot of experiences that are not the ones that it wants them to have.
Exactly.
But then the second part of it is the role of the conscious organizer. It's the conscious organizer that says to people, let me help you interpret the experience that you're having. Let me give you a historical perspective. So when Amzie Moore says, oh my God, civilizations can fall as well as rise, that consciousness exists inside his brain. He goes back to Mississippi and turns it into a material force of organizing. That's what's brilliant about what, you know, in the story you told, is that it still has to reside inside of people and organizations, which is why I read so much about the building of organizations.
All of that sounds right to me. The only thing that I would stress is that Amzi Moore and the other organizers that we're using him to symbolize are deeply rooted inside these communities. They are not a vanguard. They are not people with higher consciousness lecturing down. I understand that you know that, but I think it's important to say that.
No, sure. I think this is a great... I mean, your book is the source of... I mean, you and I would love to talk about this, which we are forever. I mean, let me say back to this, that the conflation of consciousness and arrogance is unfortunately sometimes true, but it's not inherent. You can be a local person with tremendous respect for your own community, go out and have an experience, and then it's your ability to go back and synthesize it with the experience of the people you have, to talk in the language that they understand, with the moral authority you have from having lived there your whole life, where people say, oh my God, if Amzi Moore's telling me this, this is a much more interesting story than if Eric Mann's telling me this. So I think that the organizer, I wrote a book called Playbook for Progressives, 16 Qualities of the Successful Organizer, and it's the combination, I think, of intellectual aggressiveness and being a good listener, truly humble and listening and having amazement that a sharecropper just sharecrops every day and begins with such enormous respect for the work of the people, that is that if it's done right, that's the hope.
Now, you said it better than I did, but that's the point I want to make.
Yeah, and I think that's in your book, and I think it's a wonderful, wonderful book about that. And given that, you know, one of the things, I'm very good friends with Robin D.G. Kelly and Diane Fagino, and one of the things I'm struck by historians is your phenomenal attention to detail and how many books and articles you read to get a chapter done. So just to talk about that for a minute, tell us a little bit about the kind of intellectual and academic efforts for you to figure out the consciousness of your own book, I've Got the Light of Freedom.
There was a part of it that was easy in that I think fairly early on, I developed an organizing vision, which is to say that I wanted to tell history the way I thought Ella Baker would tell it. I wanted to ask the kinds of questions that I thought she would ask. And so that gave it, for me, a working coherence. But I will tell you the truth. When I read back through the book now, I don't mean to be immodest, but sometimes I wonder how I learned all that, right? And of course, the answer is that I had a pretty great group of teachers and access to some wonderful archives and people who understood those archives and helped me do it. But that period of immersion, it's a remarkable experience.
It's funny sometimes, I'm a writer also, and sometimes, you know, I'll read something I wrote and I'll say, darn, that was pretty good. You know, where did
exactly.
I get that
every
from?
You know, while, you know,
every once in a while, but you realize that's your ninth draft. You forget that.
Exactly.
Nobody knows you worked that sentence and that paragraph. All your outtakes are not being debated, right?
And that book must have gone through pretty much six full-scale revisions, something like that, draft after draft after draft.
Well, it's a real gift. As an organizer, I've read it twice already, and I can sort of just enjoy a page. Last week, by the way, I read significant sections from it, and it'll be up on our website. And then I had a young organizer here, Ron Collins, from the Labor Community Strategy Center, who's in his early 20s, has been with us for 7 years. So I would read, and then I would ask him, what did he perceive, right, as a new generation? And then what did I perceive? And it was just very interesting, I'm sure you know, as a writer. You wonder, what the heck do people get out of what I wrote?
And sometimes you're amazed by it.
So why don't you tell us something about that? Tell us about the book as a living instrument. And you were at the SNCC reunion 3 years ago. The book's been out for a long time. How long has it been out?
Oh my gosh, is it 20 years now?
Something like that. Tell us about the life of the book a little bit. As you've gone around, talk to people, some of the feedback you've gotten, even things you've learned about your own book from the people who read it.
Two things stand out. On the positive side, the single greatest point of pride for me around this book is the degree to which people who are teaching organizing use the book as a tool in their teaching. In fact, in California one time, I know IAF was using the book in some of its trainings. I really, really like that. Okay.
That's right.
On the negative side, I'll say two things. One serious and one in my mind, more. This book, along with John Dittmer's Local People, has been attacked by Charles Eagles, who was then at the University of Mississippi, as being, I've forgotten his language now, but the point he wanted to make is that we were boosters for the movement, that we were so sympathetic to the movement that we could not be objective. And he used the word objective, not a word I think anybody needs to introduce into these conversations. I just mention that because it says something to me about the degree of just sheer academic silliness. There are mistakes in the book, and I'm perfectly happy to engage with this. But this kind of high-handed, I think, I've just got to say, traditional bourgeois notion that academics are going to be objective, that we're above it all, and that there is something wrong with being committed to that movement. Yes, I am committed to that movement.
Well, let's stay there a minute.
It's a funny kind of criticism.
Well, it's both funny and historic, right? Because my wife, Leanne Hirst Mann, has a doctorate, and she's done a lot of work on political theory, and she's made the case for what she calls affiliated intellectuals, to say that the best intellectuals are affiliated with something. You know, you don't get better by having no investment in the world. Howard Zinn, we could debate whether or not he was a good intellectual. I think he was a heck of a good intellectual, but he was always on the front lines, and his point of view was partisan. And what's strange about it is, given how much right-wing partisanship there is, the second thing is, having read Local People, because I read some of that as well, great book, and very similar in some way, if I could say, methodologically to yours.
We were writing at exactly the same time.
Very interesting, because one of the things that I don't think people understand about your books is they're very critical in the sense of critical and intellectual engagement. You're taking apart a very complex movement, explaining the debates in it, explaining the conflicts among the people, explaining the debates between Stokely and Foreman and Foreman and King. And, you know, I was there, and it was hard to navigate Byard Rustin and Fannie Lou Hamer, and there were a lot of choices that you had to make. And there were very intelligent arguments made for different paths in the road, similar to Clay Carson's book on SNCC. So to think that these books are simply cheerleading is, well, first of all, it's racist, it's a million things, but it's so intellectually dismissive of what writing social theory is about. I think what the all three books do is explain what we call line debates in the most sympathetic way, that each person's point of view is expressed almost through their eyes, through their making the best case for their argument.
The ideal.
Right? And then you did that. And then still having opinions, even if they're not explicitly stated. You're writing not simply saying that's an interesting debate. You're trying to give some, you know, you're still a participant in the intellectual argument. So I would just say, anytime you want me to debate that dude, just send me his email. I'll be happy to...
I have never thought it worth responding to. I just think it's a marker of where we are in certain kind of discussions. And the last thing I will say about it is that if what one is trying to do is write a usable history, then that gives you all the reason that you need to try to get it right. Getting it wrong because you want to glorify this political position or that political position doesn't make it usable. And I think that's a part of what he does not see. Actually, I thought of two other things I want to say about what the book got wrong. There is a section at the end which criticizes something called the Atlanta Project, a group of strongly nationalist, a wing within SNCC, that I argue in the book contributed disproportionately to the fraying of social relationships in SNCC. And even in the last year, some members of the Atlanta Project, with whom I am friends, right, people I like and enjoy, Michael Simmons, Zohara Simmons in particular, have taken me to task for the fact that I did not talk to any of them, that I relied on other sources, which at that time had not been challenged. And those sources, in retrospect, may well have painted a one-dimensional picture of that brand of black nationalism. So that was one place where, as a scholar, I just did not attend to the details of the work. The other was, at some place in the book, there is a reference to the fact that freedom schools within the movement, and I suspect you may have heard some of this, did not have as much status as other kinds of activities that were going on during Freedom Summer. And I think maybe it was 3 or 4 years ago that a group of women called me to task and said that that's a sexist remark. And in point of fact, they are right. Okay? Because what I should have said is that in the eyes of certain activists and the ones who have shaped that part of the historical record are in fact males. It was the more confrontational work, right, if you will, the more masculine kind of work that had the greatest respect. But if you were to go into those towns and ask the women who lived in those towns what was the most important thing going on in their communities, that some, a great many of them would have said freedom schools. And so that without thinking about it, when I just accepted the idea freedom schools were of lowest status within the movement, I was going from a record, but that record itself had gender biases built into it. Well, I tell that as a cautionary tale.
Well, I think both are very observant, and the idea that hopefully we grow past the consciousness of what we write, right, that we can look back at our own writing, and in this case, both of what you said, I certainly think in terms of the first one, since that's more clear, is that that was unfortunate because both are unfortunate, but the point is that, let me say a couple of thoughts. One is that we never get it all right, so we're a product of our own consciousness, so we're trying to grasp the consciousness of other people. But we have our own problems, so, you know, the books
are often
reflections of, they're often good litmus tests about ourselves as we reread things, and certainly different forms of male chauvinism and different forms of underestimating the role of women in the movement were very prevalent at the time. But also, that struggle was, I would say, one of the most advanced women's liberation movements that you saw at the time. I mean, the number of, not just Fannie Lou Hamer, but Victoria Gray and Ella Baker and
Annie Devine,
and as public figures, public mass figures, the role, certainly when I went down, I was from the North and I was with CORE, and when I would go down to the SNCC meetings, I was very aware of the power of black women in those public meetings and the SNCC Freedom Singers. And so there was certainly a very, very highly visible element of women's leadership. Another thing I think is just very interesting is the complexity of organizational relationships that SNCC had. Freedom schools, SNCC had training programs, SNCC had trying to run different institutions with almost no money. SNCC had chapters, they had contradictions between their local office and their, you know, these are built in to the structure of organizations. And one of the things that I think is disturbing to me about a lot of people today who don't want to be in the movement is they look back and say, well, SNCC did this wrong, or the Panthers did this wrong. Or I said, well, compared to what?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, these were human beings. Yeah, I mean, if that's your main point, some of that is true, but were you there when people's lives were on the line and everybody was doing their very best? And I think they did pretty great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
So thank you for, seriously, about those two observations about your work. So let me ask you a couple of thoughts. I'm assuming you're going to be back at the commemoration in Jackson. Is that correct?
I will be there for the first 3 days, I think.
Okay, wonderful. What are you trying to figure out now about the active legacy of the SNCC Black Liberation tradition? You know, there's an important quote from Cleveland Sellers that said that, you know, we went into the Democratic Convention in August of 1964 thinking we were fighting for civil rights, and we came out knowing we were fighting for black liberation. And that took place in 2 weeks. How do you see the work that was done in the 60s with all its different points of view? What impacts do you think it's having on today? And what are some of the things that you wished it was having more impact about?
Is that one question?
that's your next book. We'll make it a two-part question. So part one is, what do you think were the legacies of SNCC that you think are having a positive impact on today's generation?
As far as I am concerned, SNCC, more than any other institution, created for that generation an image of what the activist was. I think a great many of the other organizations that flowered in that period shaped their conception of activism largely in response to SNCC's, right? So I think at that level alone, it's an enormous contribution. And the fact that I don't expect a cop to crack me across the head when I'm in Mississippi next year, I think that is directly related, not just to SNCC, but in Mississippi, largely SNCC, right?
Right.
The fact that police terrorism is no longer an institutionalized phenomenon in much of the South, that's a great contribution. And I'm speaking now as someone who began college in 1966, the year that Black Power came to public notice.
Right.
It gave black folk the right to be assertive, right? to insist on some things as opposed to always asking for some things, to think with reference to what we wanted to do as opposed to thinking with reference to what white people were going to think of us. There are still some problems in that regard. Okay? But SNCC and the other nationalists of that generation pushed the agenda forward in some really important ways.
Let me add on that, and then we'll get to things you wished that were impacting. I mean, I would add that certainly my life has been shaped completely by the SNCC model, and that the concept of the organizer, which is an underappreciated understanding, is, first of all, just a person who would like to work with other people. That starts with you're a social being, that you think history is made by masses and by people and believes in building institutions. At the reunion of SNCC 3 years ago, I was so struck by how many people said about James Forman being the formative person in their life, sweeping the floor, which he did, I'm sure, partly as a Zen ritual.
Oh, he did, no question.
Right? Partly as a way of truly trying to model a certain humility of a man being willing to sweep the floor, because so many women said that I was talking to Jim Forman while he was sweeping the floor, which I thought was interesting. And his commitment to training, this is another example of things not said, his commitment to training women to be frontline leaders. How many women stood up and said it was Jim Forman who told me I could do this? Who just said, I don't care if you never did the job before. You'll learn. You're in charge, which we try to do at the Strategy Center. Promote people and give them the confidence and then give them the training. I think the issue of, when I joined the Civil Rights Movement, the first question they asked is, are you willing to put your body on the line? And I think maybe one reason I didn't go south is I wasn't sure that that level of body on the line I was able to. And in the North, I was able to rise to whatever the challenges were there. But the idea that part of being in the movement was of a true understanding of physical danger and possible death and dismemberment was an incredible quality. And another thing I'll say is, which is true of black folks in general, but an amazing sense of humor in the middle of all this. Where SNCC got its sense of true humor and irony and laughter and happiness in the middle of all this pain is another model that I think all good organizers should have, which is people would like to be around optimistic, upbeat people. And they modeled it, and I think it was a tremendous gift.
I've never heard that put it very well. I've never heard it put quite that way before. And then it raises the question, what happened to the humor? I mean, what happened to the capacity for laughing at oneself as nationalism flourished in some ways? One of the great contradictions, I guess, of nationalism, which is presenting itself always as a unifying philosophy, is that the actual social relationships under nationalism are often not particularly healthy relationships. In some ways, they're the competitive relationships of the larger society inside the movement. And so how you have a form of radicalism, nationalism, that retains a connection to the African-American traditions of humanism, that in the end we're not that different from one another, and that in the end we all have obligations to everyone else. How you maintain those two things is still one of the things that I'm struggling to understand.
Me too. I've been in communist organizations, I've been in revolutionary organizations. I know in one particular organization, in my opinion, had no sense of humor, and in fact, I was criticized for having a sense of humor. You know, like it was like, seriously, comrade, you can't take this thing too seriously with, you know, and
when the revolution comes, there will be no comedians.
That's right, there'll be no comedians. You know, the other thing is that I think you're right about is that the tradition of the humor I was trained in was a self-deprecating, an ironic sense of humor, you know, an awareness of the contradiction of ourselves as people, which came out of a much deeper self-confidence. But I would put a better spin on it, maybe, Charles, to say this, that as the repression intensified and as people felt that the nonviolent way was not working, the Democratic Party way was not working, people were really at the end of their rope. I think one possible explanation is that people were scared and people were trying to toughen themselves up and felt that a sort of a military demeanor, as they believed it to be, was necessary for survival, because I'm thinking of the Black Panthers in particular, who were some very wonderful, wonderful people, and yet went through hell and woke up every morning from, you know, Fred Hampton had a great sense of humor. I mean that. And I just thought about that. Fred Hampton had a great sense of humor, was shot in his bed. So I think you're right. about what happened when the movement moved into a more nationalist, militarist, even in some good senses. That's a whole other conversation, right? That's a conundrum that I don't know the answer to.
Nor do I. And I think what you're saying is perfectly plausible, reaction to repression for a part of it. But I just have this gut feeling that other things were going on.
Oh, me too. That's why we'll keep doing the history, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any personal objectives that you want to get done at the 50th anniversary?
So only as a teacher. A friend of mine, you may know her, Mia Henry. She used to run the Chicago Freedom School.
I know her very well.
She is taking a busload of high school students down, and I am sort of tagging along. And my motivation for going is primarily to see how high school students, how they think about this, right? How it's going to affect them. I'm really trying to learn, how do you teach to that age group?
Oh, I'm doing a lot of thinking about that, too. You know, Mia Henry is a good friend of mine. Tell her hello.
Will do.
We did a voting rights referendum for Trayvon Martin in Los Angeles that I thought was pretty cool. My own organization did it. And what we did was we went into South L.A., targeted 850,000-person community, about half black and half Latino, and did a bilingual people's referendum asking President Obama to both indict George Zimmerman and also to indict the police department there for violating Trayvon's civil rights. And we did it in a way that we built it on the freedom vote theory. Robin Kelly did an article about it, where we get everybody to vote. So whether you had a criminal record, whether you were an immigrant, and we issued essentially a referendum asking President Obama and Attorney General Holder to indict both the police department and Zimmerman. And we wanted to put a lot of pressure on the president, which, in my opinion, the civil rights movement did not do.
Mm-hmm.
And we asked people all over the country to help us, and the one person who called was Mia Henry. So she said, we're going to do one in Chicago. So she did a freedom vote in Chicago on the people's referendum, and we worked very closely there. So I think the work she's doing, I think all this issue about freedom schools is something I'd like to learn more about. And I think how young people think is a really important subject. And I think Mia's work is really important. So that's very cool that the two of you are working together.
I think so, too.
And do you plan to write about it?
In some form or fashion. Over the next couple of years, I plan to spend a lot of time thinking about how these forms of education affect young people and what's the best way to do them. You know, one of the things that I work with a group of people on the South Side of Chicago who will be opening Children's Defense Fund Freedom Schools, I think it's our fourth summer. At least our third, but I think it's our fourth. And all apart from the impact that they have on children and their families, which caught me off guard, I see them as a great organizing opportunity. Once people have seen them, they want them. And so I think the potential around that is just enormous. And so I'm trying to learn as much as I can.
I'm reading in from some of the bio statements. It says, Charles M. Payne is a Frank P. Hickson professor in the School of Social Service Administration, University of Chicago. His interests include urban education and school reform, social inequality, social change, and modern African-American history. He's working on a book that continues the conversation from So Much Reform, tentatively entitled Fragile Victories, The State of the Debate on Urban School Reform. This will be a strategic overview of what we should have learned about large-scale change in urban schools over the last decade and how our deeply polarized national debate keeps us from acting on the best practices. So in terms of the debate between the charter schools and the private schools and the public schools, there seems to be a third position that's trying to at least engage itself in the debate, and that's the freedom schools. Do you think that's fair or accurate?
I think it would be a good idea if it were true. I'm not sure that they have the profile, the traction in this conversation right now, not just the schools, but that entire idea. One of the unfortunate aspects of the charter school movement is that it has very little conception of how young people develop. It is such a narrow focus on test scores. And by and large, the progressive response to that has been largely apolitical in the way that it thinks about development. I mean, they think about character issues more, I think, than they think about the whole child more, but not to going to the point of raising issues about civic engagement, racial socialization, the kinds of issues that are raised in a freedom school environment.
Well, this is a subject that's going on in Los Angeles, obviously. I know the Chicago people are fighting
right
about it, and it's it's an area that's out of my expertise. It's something I'm trying to get my head around, and there's so many things I'm studying. But one of the things I'm trying to figure out is, we used to have a theory on how black children would learn, right? And there was a theory that said, fundamentally, first beginning with racial respect and support, with experimentation based on the child's ability to perform at a pace that was appropriate, compensatory work around whether it would be family or reading disabilities, you know, the idea of tutoring and investing more money, believing in the child, socially relevant curriculum. You know, in the 60s, there was a lot of thought about how black and Latino children could succeed. And there were some very, you know, there was IS 201 in Harlem. There was Ocean Hill, Brownsville. I was involved with both of those movements that seemed very exciting at the time and very kind of theoretically driven in the very best sense of that. Have you studied those movements and what's happened to them?
No, not as movements. I mean, again,
it was experiments.
I was in college in the 60s and early 70s and beginning to think in a systematic way about schools. Some of those currents have just been a part of my life, but not particularly a part of what I study as a scholar.
Well, I think we both should, at least for myself, as I'm saying it, there's a really good book that was written, I don't know what it is, about, I know about the Ocean Hill Brownsville experience. And I actually taught a little bit at IS 201.
Oh, wow.
At the time, I was working with a guy named Herbert Cole, who was doing work around low-income kids and how they write. And I just went back to a reunion of a dear friend of mine who had been a leader in the Newark Community Union Project in 65, 66. And so I'm 71. So this guy comes up to me, maybe he's 55 or 60, and says, I want to thank you for taking me to Columbia University for those writing classes. I'm going, what? I don't even remember. But he said it changed my whole life, just being able to get out of here and somebody told me I could read, you know, and told me you believed in me. So there was a lot of interesting things done that I'd like to go back and study, is my point. I'd like to go back and from Septima Clark to the Freedom Schools to Ocean Hill Brownsville and IS 201. I think maybe there's something that could help the debate today.
I don't think there's any question about that at all.
So what's the status of black students today at the University of Chicago? What's their consciousness like? What are you trying to do there?
I teach in the School of Social Work, and so my students are not representative. I get a lot more black students here. They're older. They have BAs when they come. And because they're in social work, they're very, very much attuned to issues of social justice. So when I came here, I actually gave up teaching about the civil rights movement because I'm not a social worker. I don't understand their traditions. The students sort of pushed me gradually into teaching that material again because they saw the relevance of it to social justice as a component of the social work ethos that I did not understand until they pointed it out to me. And so for me, it's just a wonderful context to be teaching it, because I have students who want to do something and are trying to figure out, just as we all were at that age, what's the best way for them to contribute to a better world.
What would you say is the racial composition of the students you're teaching right now in terms of black percentages?
I'd say black and Latino students are probably about 25% of the student body where I am, and that's in the School of Social Work. It's obviously just going to be a fraction of that for the university as a whole.
Well, that's very wonderful. Because at UCLA, they've just virtually driven black students out of the university.
Not UCLA, but that entire University of California
system. That's right. I mean, 3% black admission. It's just absolutely, you know, after all we work for. So, I mean, having at least a critical mass of 25 to 30% black and Latino students, I think changes just the whole culture of the conversation, I'm assuming.
Well, that plus the fact that social work acknowledges the validity of race, acknowledge that race is a part of what we have to struggle with and around. At the same time, I'm hesitating, wondering, a great many of the black and Latino students here would say that they find discussions about race in this context unsatisfying, that they still find people who are uncomfortable talking about it, unwilling to talk about it beyond the superficial, only capable of talking about it in deficit terms. So there is a higher conversation here than elsewhere. It is still, I think, in the eyes of many students, a problematic conversation.
And what are the white students like? I mean, are they, I come out of obviously this tradition of the ferociously anti-racist whites, you know, I mean, whose life was, you know, Mickey Schwerner was a social worker. If summer of 64, I was working in a settlement house in the South Bronx, and when Shorna Goodman and Cheney were missing, the guy that was my boss said, "Do you know who Mickey Shorna was?" I said, "No." He says, "He was the enfant terrible of the social work school." He said, "Get out of social work and get into social justice." Or, you know, he says, "We got to, at least if you're going to be in social work, you have to be part of movement to transform your communities." He said, "Half of us should quit and the other half should get a lot better." So what are the white students like right now in terms of their consciousness, and especially about race?
There are a lot of people who would resonate to the story you just told. There are a lot of people who worry about whether social work is actually constituted in a way that it can be something other than an apology for the system. That's a very live question among them. And again, even here, because of who I am and what I teach, I get a particular kind of student, those who are most concerned with social justice. And among them, I think one of my pet worries about white students is that they want so badly to be anti-racist that sometimes it distorts their thinking. They're trying so hard that there are things they cannot think about or cannot talk about because they don't want to be perceived as racist.
That's pretty deep.
And again, you have to respect where that sentiment's coming from, but you can't work at a high level that way.
Well, Charles, I'm serious. When we see each other in Mississippi and we keep talking or even having you back on the show, I'd love to even explore that. You know, I think that's a terrific conversation. I mean, I was very lucky, obviously. I was the only white field secretary in Corps in the North. People were, you talk about tough love, I got very tough love, you know, and it was like, you better really start shaping up. And almost everything I said was wrong the first 6 months. You know, every concept was deconstructed.
You were in Newark?
Well, first I was in Harlem with the Congress of Racial Equality, and I worked in 38 Park Row, which was the national office. So I worked with Brooklyn and Bronx Corps, which were the so-called black militants. Those were the ones I was always most attracted to, and those were the ones who actually liked me. So they trusted me, but they trusted, as they said, the thing we like about you the most is you understand, you don't understand.
That says it perfectly.
So we can teach you stuff. But it was hard to be taught so many things per day. You know, it was like they weren't talking about a few lessons. They were talking about reconstructing a worldview. And I think for white students that have not been in majority black contexts, or have not to feel the power of a black community, you know, but are trying to sort of work it through in their head, it must be very hard. And as you said, it must be very hard on the black students thinking, oh my God, is this really what I want to be? I mean, with all due respect, is this what I want to hear you guys talk about right now?
I think you got it right for both sides.
Well, so do you. And I think they're really lucky to have you. And if I can say, your level of introspection, the level of having a conversation where we're both thinking out loud is the model of the show. But I have to say, Charles, you've really been great about just allowing us to try to explore the things we don't know, you know.
And I really appreciate you giving me an opportunity just to think a lot about these things. So thank you very much.
We'll definitely do it again, and I'll see you in Mississippi.
Very good. See you in Mississippi.
Take good care of yourself.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Boy, am I lucky to do this show. This is Eric Mann. I'm the host of Voices from the Frontlines. That was Charles M. Payne. And go out and you better get that book, I've Got the Light of Freedom, like right now on any, I hate to say the word Amazon, but anywhere you can get it in 2-day delivery. It's just a true classic. Next week, we'll be recording from Mississippi with Julian Lamb. I want to thank Crystal McMillan, who does an amazing job of being producer of this show. And I just want to thank all of you out there for taking the show so seriously and making it a real pleasure to be the host of Voices from the Frontlines. I want to thank our engineer, as always, G. You'll be talking next Tuesday at 4. Take good care, and all power to the people. The sun, I'll say.